you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get some money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Mr. Hugo Turner on the show. Hugo, how are you doing?
Good. Great to be on.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. Now, you penned several articles, but this one was particularly interesting on Ted Shackley. Ted Shackley, A Life in the CIA. Well, first of all, your website is Anti-Imperialist U.
At blogspot.com.
Okay. And that's where you primarily write and post your stuff, your material? Okay. Is anywhere else where people go to find your work?
Yeah. You can find my work at SOT and at Global Research as well.
Okay. And you've also penned a series of articles regarding Iran-Contra, which, of course, involves Mr. Shackley, which I urge people to go see that those articles as well because they're relevant to what we're talking about tonight. And is any other anything else you've done that you want to mention or that I'm missing? Or
I've written a lot of articles about different CIA operations that all exactly would be involved in or whatever.
Okay,
but you know, they could just check out my site, or, like, do a search for Nazis in the CIA or Operation Gladio.
Okay,
or Operation Condor, and you could find it.
All that nasty stuff. Yes. So, you have this article, Ted Shackley, A Life in the CIA. Mr. Shackley, what does his life, his career in the agency, maybe after he left the agency, supposedly, what does it tell us about the United States, the American Empire, and the world we live in today?
Basically, Shackley's career is sort of like a window onto, like, the dark hidden history of, like, the Cold War and even, like, the roots of, like, what's going on now with, like, the War on Terror, because Shackley was involved in, like, the CIA's most notorious operations, like the plot to assassinate Castro, the terror campaign against Cuba, drug smuggling in Laos. He worked with the Nazis in Germany, and he worked on the Phoenix program in Vietnam, and then he was, like, involved in Iran-Contra, the JFK assassination, like, and even, like, 9/11 was partly a result of, like, stuff he was involved in, like, far earlier, in, like, in the 80s. So he like interconnects to all like the, what, you know, Peter Dale Scott would call the deep events of the post-war period, and you know, he is involved in all these ugly covert wars the U.S. is involved in. Yeah, basically, the lesson of Shackley's life is that the CIA has like complete impunity to do whatever it wants. It's just basically a criminal organization that's above the law, and the Congress and stuff like that is all just pretty powerless compared to the CIA.
Now, the fact that Ted Shackley shows up in all these supposedly, you know, disparate events, of course, we know they're all connected, suggests that there's a relatively small group of people that are carrying out these things, correct? For another group of people, Wall Street, the banks, whatever, right?
Yeah, there's not just Shackley, but like what Daniel Sheehan called the secret team, which is like all his friends that, from these different operations or whatever. And yeah, basically, of the really dirty operations the CIA is involved in, like drug dealing or support for terrorism and things like that, they only, like, there's a small group of people that are, like, know, like, the darkest secrets. And, like, Shackley is definitely, like, who's, like, a leader of these people.
And I guess many of those secrets went to the grave with him, perhaps, right?
Definitely. Because he was very secretive. Like, some of these guys, like Thomas Klein, sort of had big mouths and would, like, say stuff, but Shackley, he just kept everything. He's very good at covering his tracks and concealing his role.
Now, how did Shackley, I believe he was born in 1927, and he was, well, in his, maybe in his, from his perspective, unfortunately, too young to go to World War II. Some people say he was fortunate to miss that. So he's born 1927. He's of Polish background?
Yeah, his mother was Polish, and she was a Polish immigrant, but she pretended that she was born here. But Shackley learned Polish as a child from his grandmother, who was like pretending to be his aunt. So it's like his mother was sort of like, he got this secretive and deceptive quality from his mother. Mm-hmm. His father was sort of like this angry, mean guy. So those are Shackley's parents.
So is that his stepfather?
Well, his first father was like an angry drunk that his mother left, and then she remarried this rich guy in Florida that Shackley never got along with. He was forced to move in with his high school football coach.
Okay.
And then, like, after, like you said, he wanted to join the war, but it ended right before like he graduated from high school, so he can go. But then, like, he did end up joining the military right after that, and then it was before the CIA was founded, but he was recruited into this thing called the CIC, this counterintelligence corps of the military.
Uh-huh.
And that's where his career in intelligence began. So it's sort of like right out of high school, he's immediately into this secret world. And then, like, he's sent to Germany. He attends this top secret intelligence academy at Aberammergau with all, like, these fascist instructors and, like, these notorious intelligence agents from around the world were being trained there in, like, psychological warfare and what they call special warfare and things like that. Basically, like, terrorism and propaganda. Like, the school, you know, the type of skill the CIA requires. And then he goes into college, and then he's recruited into the CIA when the Korean War starts.
That's 1950. So that's June, the summer of 1950. And so he is, looking, he's 22, 23. That's pretty heady stuff for a young guy. I mean,
Definitely.
To get thrown into, like, that world.
Right out of high school, he's joining into this.
Yeah.
So he's like, only.
And of course, he had a poor relationship with his father, sort of a distant or ambivalent stepfather. So you would kind of get a psychological makeup for these. This is like, that's prime material for intelligence agencies, at least from my understanding.
Yeah, in fact, the people in the CIA, they had this rumor that Shackley was like an orphan raised by the CIA because he was like so intense and into it. So
yeah.
He let him believe that because he wanted to know about like his mom or his drug dad.
And you say he spoke Polish, so that was very useful, for most of the Cold War, particularly in the early days of the Cold War, the high Cold War period, the 50s and the early 60s. And it also probably shaped his outlook, right? Because he's this Cold War warrior.
And he also learned German. Yeah, I couldn't quite figure out when, but he also was very fluent in German. And in fact, some people, like Daniel Sheehan, claims that Shackley was the translator for Reinhard Galen.
Oh, okay.
There's like this early period, but that, I don't know if that's really true or not.
Yeah. Of course, Galen was the head of the Eastern Intelligence for Germany. Of course, the Russo-German War, that, you know, horrible conflict in the East, and he was incorporated or recruited by the OSS after the Second World War. This was the Alan Dulles doing this, and he, I guess, for the most part, the Galen network formed the Soviet desk at the fledgling CIA. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, definitely. All like the spies that the CIA was relying on were all these actually Nazi collaborators and Nazis of the Galen organization. It wasn't just like he had like all the Germans, but then he also had all like the spies that the Nazis had been running during the war or whatever. Like, all the so that was their only window into the world, was like what Galen was telling them, and that's like it was in Galen's interest that the Cold War would get started as quick as possible, because that would mean that America would become an ally of the Nazis, and like, you know, they'd be worried about the Russians. So they were like hyping up the Russian threat big time and always lying and saying there's about to be like a Soviet invasion. Mm-hmm. So like all that Cold War hysteria was actually generated by these fascists.
Yes. And of course that helped the corporate interest back in the United States, because that served the justification for NSC 68 and the military industrial complex and the military Keynesianism that would come to define post-war America, the economy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, all that. I think it was, I forget who said it, that if the Soviets weren't an enemy, that we would have had to create one to justify all the spending. But it was Senator Vandenberg who told Harry Truman, when Harry Truman, you know, proposed this to him, he said, "You got to scale the hell out of the American people, Harry." You know, so
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. He's in his early 20s. This is the Cold War period. This is the Korean War. This is the era of McCarthy. This is a very confusing time period, because again, what you're saying is now the United States is cozying up to the Nazis, or erstwhile, you know, our enemies, and now our erstwhile allies, the Soviets, are the enemies. This is right out of George Orwell, isn't it? I mean, it's
well, yeah, of course. People like Alan Dulles were actually, like, you know, funding the rise of Hitler and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Some people in America were always aligned with the Nazis.
Uh-huh.
The big industrialists and so on, a lot of them.
Yeah, but when you get into this higher, because when you get into the Cold War itself, which I've come to kind of look at it as a kind of a strategy of tension writ large, where depending on what level you're on, you have a different view of the conflict, whereas, you know, the whole first half of the 20th century was an attempt to kind of like consolidate and manipulate and change the world through warfare. And you got the First World War. The second act was the Second World War. And, of course, that leads to the Cold War. And all the while, you're getting these the industrial power, the industries, the banks are making money off all the warfare.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But yeah, a good example is you mentioned the Galen network, and you know, the Galen network. So what I understand is he helped train the Mossad.
like a Mossad guy went to that same school that I was talking about.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's where like some of these they all would meet, and they met at this school. So it's sort of like this, a special club of evilest secret agents from around the world, including Israel.
But
Israel is often aligned with these fascists, ironically.
Yeah,
Like all the wacko countries, Israel was aligned with, like Argentina and Taiwan and all these fascist type
things. Is now, of course, at Shackley's level, he's sort of a, is he a true believer, a soldier, or he's just kind of a, you know.
I think he's like a true, it's like an American style like of fascism, where it's just like, you know, anti-communism. I don't know if he hated the Jews or anything, but he was just, you know, you have to, whenever he saw poor people rising up anywhere in the world, you know, or even environmentalism and stuff, he's like, these are terrorists, they're communists, we have to, like, kill them. He was very much we got to, like, eliminate all these subversives type of mentality.
Yeah, it was almost like whenever, like, in Guatemala, Arbenz, he was first painted red to justify the coup for the benefit of United Fruit or something. And same thing with in Iran, of all places, which, you know, where Mossadegh was then, because Mossadegh had run afoul of, of British Petroleum. And I guess it was then it was Anglo-Iranian oil, but it came British Petroleum. But these the minute that some of these developing countries or research-rich countries were governments would assert themselves, they'd be painted red, and there'd be a coup for the benefit of Wall Street or the City of London. That was the strategy. Same thing, into the 70s with Chile. Of course, as you mentioned, that Shackley's involved in all this.
Shackley was in charge of it back in Washington, and he sent his right-hand man, Thomas Clydesdale, to personally handle this Chilean coup.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's one of his more notorious operations.
Now,
people should see this movie called Missing, which is about the Chilean coup that I watched a week ago. It was really a great movie.
Oh, with Sissy Spacek and Jack Lemmon.
Yeah.
And where that reporter is murdered during the 73 coup, yeah. It is a good movie, actually. Yeah, it's got that creepy CIA guy. as far as, because you have Shackley, he goes to Korea.
He goes back to Germany.
Okay, he's in Germany during the Korean. So he's never in Korea. He's in Germany doing intelligence. He speaks Polish fluently, and
he's put in charge of all of the satellite country desk. Basically, so he's like this meteoric rise because he makes friends with his first mentor is William Harvey, like a notorious CIA guy who started out in the FBI and would later be in charge of the Castro assassination plot with the mafia or whatever,
uh-huh.
DR rifle. And so with Harvey liked him because he wasn't from an elite background like a lot of these other CIA guys.
That's right. He went to University of Maryland, correct?
Yeah.
Not Yale or Princeton or something, yeah.
He could have gone to Princeton, but he chose to go to University of Maryland to be with his best friend from high school, honestly. With Harvey's help, he has this meteoric rise, and he's put in charge of all of the Eastern European countries. They're not Soviet, all the Warsaw Pact ones, Poland, mm-hmm. Czechoslovakia, and Hungary, etc. And so his next major role is in, after the failure of the Bay of Pigs, he's put in charge of Operation Mongoose, or at least the... He's the chief of station in Miami that's in charge of it, with Harvey as his boss, and then RFK kind of overseeing the whole thing.
So he's rubbing elbows with Lansdale and those guys.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Lansdale was the mastermind, Lansdale was an ad man, and he just had he would just brainstorm a bunch of ideas that half of them were completely insane and impractical, and then So the CIA is more of a bureaucracy, they're working out what they're working out. They're not going to drop everything because Lansdale decides on some crazy scheme or something. So he was sort of out of this, he wasn't as influential anymore by the 60s as he had been in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. And Lansdale, some say, wasn't he the model for the quiet American?
Oh, he was, yeah.
Yeah.
Ugly American.
And the ugly American. Yeah, Marlon Brando, yeah. The Graham Greene, the quiet American. Because in the 50s, prior to, overt American involvement, you had the OSS, then CIA, at least from my understanding, kind of nudging the French out and largely to take over the heroin trade. But then by the 1960s, you get the escalation in Vietnam, and where the CIA kind of steps in, but also kind of hands it off to the Pentagon to turn it into a full scale war.
Yeah, basically the CIA. It started during the OSS were in Vietnam during the war, and they were actually working with the Viet Minh. But then after that, they signed with the French. But then another people like Lansdale, who knew the French were going to lose, they were, trying to build up their South Vietnamese puppet government, Diem. And so, they installed Diem in there, and then he was basically a fascist who had this brutal crackdown, but back home he was told, we have to protect this democracy in South Vietnam. There was no democracy. He was a brutal dictator or whatever, and his, brother-in-law was a gangster in charge of the heroin trade, you say. So, Shackley wouldn't go to Vietnam until after the Tet Offensive, but...
Oh, so Shackley's physically not in Vietnam until after 1968?
Yeah, he goes there in 68, but he'd been in Laos from 65 to 68.
Oh, so there he's recruiting or mobilizing the Hmong people. Of course, to do that, he has to make all types of alliances, which involves the drug trade, right? And this is where he teams up with Richard C. Cord, later of Iran-Contra infamy.
Yep. And a lot of those Iran-Contra people, a lot of them were in Laos. And they're all like David Morales. And yeah, Richard C. Cord was the Air Force liaison to like the secret war in Laos. And at one point, Sackley had Richard C. Cord bomb this rival drug syndicate to like Vang Pao, the leader, the general of the Hmong, so that Vang Pao could win this drug war. So he basically calls in the American Air Force as part of like a war over a drug turf war.
Mm-hmm. So he's using American air power to empower basically, one cartel against another.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, both of them, like the other ones were like the KMT that like the CIA had also been working with since like the 40s, basically, or even before there was a CIA, these Chinese nationalists had been dealing drugs. But they had to make sure that Vang Pao got all the profits from Laos so that he could fund the secret war, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they bombed the KMT.
And of course, with the KMT, Kuomintang Party, there's this remnant force that was funded by the heroin trade. And the CIA always had some sort of idea of using that to sort of harass or cause Red China problems, right? That was the idea.
They were sort of like the original Contras. They're funded through drugs, and they're like waging guerrilla war on communist China.
They were in Burma, right? Some sort of remnant force in Burma?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're in Burma and in Taiwan and like all over the place, really.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually the money from the heroin that the KMT was selling was going to fund Joe McCarthy to create all this hysteria. So, like, the part that wasn't caused by the Nazis was caused by, like, these Taiwanese drug money funding the whole Red Scare just basically because it was, like, in these people's interest.
That's really interesting because you get so much intrigue there because you have, with McCarthy, because you had elements within the national security state going against McCarthy.
Once McCarthy decided to investigate the CIA.
Well, that's like, what's interesting.
Bye-bye McCarthy.
Because what was my thing is, was he going to reveal the family jewels too early? And that's so I'm thinking, what was it because they thought McCarthy was a danger to freedom? I don't think the CIA worried about that.
No, first he was like a useful tool, but then once he started to like trying to mess with Alan Dulles himself, it's like no.
That's what's funny, yeah. Because I mean, if you look at McCarthy and the whole communist thing is that the people are identifying some sort of penetration or threat in organization, and indeed it does exist, but the true meaning of it is unclear. If you look at it, you have this Dulles faction, which is pro-Nazi. This is right after World War II, and you have this.
McCarthy was also pro-Nazi, by the way.
Yeah,
that's where that's who was feeding him all his intelligence and who all these.
Oh, these communists were.
Two commies were McCarthy's kind of mentality.
But then you have the foundations, the Reese Committee hearings and the foundation funding of the Institute for Pacific Relations, and the fact that Mao himself had been educated by Yale Divinity School. And the intrigues of the OSS in China actually supporting Mao at some point because perhaps they saw him as a way to destabilize China. We see it today, what China's become. It's sort of this unfolding plan.
I think it was probably because, of course, the communists were the ones who were fighting the Japanese, the nationalists were just trying to, stockpile weapons for when they had to fight the communists after the war.
Yeah, yeah.
They were allied with these groups that were communists during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mao was now like an American puppet, basically.
Mm. well, it's too big and bulky, but I'm saying he's certainly a, if you look at it from...
The Americans, they were more concerned about fighting the Japanese during the war, hated like the nationalists because they were just like, all they cared about was making money off the drug traffic. And they were perfectly willing to, like, that's why one of the reasons the communists won after the war was because after the Japanese surrendered, the nationalists recruited all like the Chinese that had been traitors that served mm-hmm. the Japanese, and they also were even working with the Japanese troops themselves right after World War II. And they like for 2 years the Japanese were used to fight the communists in China with like And there was actually like hundreds of thousands of American troops in China fighting this war. And like nobody remembers this.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's right. So, well, you have what, Claire Chennault, the Flying Tigers, and these things.
Yeah, it was, 'cause
that was even before Pearl Harbor, so it was illegal. And that was also funded by heroin, from what I understand.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this goes back to the late '30s. You know, these networks, and of course this involves the development and growth of the CV Star Insurance Company, which became AIG.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing that most people don't know. Like,
because so all these corporate, I mean, you have these wars, but the same these wars, these networks of trade and commerce and banking are being created that aren't going to go away when the war ends. They're going to want to persist, and maybe
it meets up with all these people when he's in Miami. Doing the Castro thing, that's what he meets up with William Pauley, Desmond Fitzgerald, who's like, you know, like CB Starr's partner.
Yeah.
And I forget.
And CB Starr's, great nephew is Kenneth Starr.
Oh, I didn't know that. Unbelievable.
And Kenneth Starr is the one that focuses on Monica Lewinsky and not at MENA, Arkansas.
Well, yeah, Ken Starr was involved in like a bunch of dirty Iran-Contra related stuff.
Didn't he write that memo in 81 or 82, William French Smith memo, that kind of told the CIA that they could look the other way, get in legal cover? This is the run-up to the Contra War. I mean, we're jumping ahead now.
I think that was Ed Meese. Yeah, I think that was Ed Meese.
So, but I think it was Ken Starr actually wrote the memo.
Oh, cool.
So, I mean, I'm just,
he worked for Ed Meese.
Yeah,
right.
So
I just learned about that like a week ago.
Yeah, I'm just saying, then you get this, you know, AIG. Then you wonder why AIG was bailed out, because Goldman, I mean, now we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but it's amazing.
Yeah, insurance, the mafia, huge financial crime and stuff.
Yeah,
That's where, like, Declan gets involved with, like, Paul Halliwell, and that was the third one name I was thinking of.
So he's involved
when he's in Miami.
He's in Laos. He gets involved in the heroin trade. And of course, many people know what happened there. The heroin, it became the Vietnam War became a conduit to ship drugs back in the United States. Now, it also created a huge market because hundreds of thousands of troops became addicted to heroin.
Yeah, and it was the South Vietnamese generals that were, each general was sort of like the mob boss of the area. So they were the ones who were supplying this heroin to the U.S. troops that were getting addicted. It's just like, these are our allies.
Mm-hmm. And
of course, America totally looked the other way and didn't care and covered it up.
And this also coincides with Nixon's war on drugs, where he's shutting down the French connection, but at the same time, he's opening up the pipeline from Vietnam, which is running through Mexico into Las Vegas, if I got that correct.
Yeah, and there's the Nixon war on drugs, which is probably one of the things that caused him to get Watergate out of office.
Yes.
His war with the CIA.
Here we are in Vietnam, and this all that money has to be deposited somewhere, right? And they open up this bank, right? This was in Australia.
Nugent, like that's sort of like in the period like when it's sort of ending. But yeah, as the Vietnam War is ending, they opened up this Nugent Hand Bank in Australia, which is this huge drug money laundering bank that's also used to finance like arms sales all over the world for what I call World War III, like the huge covert wars that are going on.
So it's like BCCI of the BCCI.
It was
the
original BCCI. Yeah, after Nugent Hand closed, that's when they had to open up the BCCI. Mm-hmm. And like Nugent Hand was actually a placement for Castle Bank.
Okay. Yeah. And Castle Bank is the one in the Bahamas, right?
Yeah.
And that was one that Paul Halliwell set up with the Vatican.
Paul Halliwell, he was like working for Meyer Lansky.
And from what I understand, Paul Halliwell also played a very instrumental role in helping Disneyland get built, or Disney World. Was it Disneyland or Disney World?
That's right.
Yeah, and that goes to, was it Donovan's law firm or something? Some weird deal. That's even weird because if you look back at the history of Disneyland in Florida, it broke ground in 1953, 54, the same year that MKUltra got started. And both enterprises, MKUltra and Disneyland, SRI was involved in that. Yeah.
Interesting.
I guess you could look at Disney and say that it's an
well, like, when I think of Disney and I think of MKUltra,
exactly.
It's like brainwashing
world of
America's children.
Yes.
And like whitewashing Like, Disney's like, you know, what Disney does to, like, fairy tales is sort of like what America does to history. They just, like,
there you go. That's
all
right.
The interesting parts, all the grown-up parts, and just having this, like, kind of, like, sweet, innocent tale. It's like, oh, we just want to spread freedom and democracy.
Yeah, yeah. And so Paul Helliwell, because I talked to Pierce Rebin about that. He did a thing. We had a whole show talking about Disney and CIA. I thought it was a wonderful, just looking into that relationship tells you about all about America. America really is kind of an amusement park, you know.
I did an interview with Pierce Rebin about Ted Sackley.
Oh yeah, I've listened to it. I got it.
Cool.
Good interview, yeah. But yeah, it's one of those things where SRI, MK Ultra, Disney, and Disney Corporation. But the Castle Bank, where again that was used, and that I guess that involves like was that the Mary Carter Paint Company, and they built Resorts International down there.
Yeah, and then it was all connected with Traficante, who was like all the Cubans that Sackley was using. They were like Traficante monsters, and then like Traficante was losing all the heroin that was coming out of Vietnam and Laos. So.
And you mentioned that Santo Traficante, he wasn't Italian. His name was what, Patron Saint of Traffickers or something? Santo Traficante.
Yeah, it's like a fake name that means basically like, yeah, Saint of Traffickers. It's not his real name. I think he's like some kind of Middle Easterner or something. I don't know. I forget exactly what he is, but I know he's not Italian.
And he was the one that they thought was kind of, he's either a double or a triple agent with Castro, right?
It's not that he may have been betraying, but I don't know. For sure.
Yeah, well, just covering, because I think his concerns weren't bothered by Castro or something. He had some deal struck in Cuba or something indicated.
Well, he was, actually, all his people were the ones waging the war, but I think at the same time, who knows. But, like, it doesn't have to be private candidate that would be betraying stuff, because the Cubans just, obviously, if you have, like, all these exiles, it was very easy for the Cubans to, like, send fake exiles into join all these different organizations.
Yes, yeah.
So they knew what was going on. And the Cuban community was, like, famous for, like, bragging about everything they did and having terrible security. So you could just have some Cubans sitting in a bar or something, and he would overhear all this, what they were planning to do, everything they've done, and, you know.
And
they also, they trained all the Americans later found out, like, all like the agents they thought they had in Cuba had all been doubled by the Cubans.
Mm-hmm.
That was like the 80s or 70s, I think.
And in Newquinhand, that was it 1980 that the bank shuts down? Was it that late?
Yeah. Frank Nugent is found dead. The Australian businessman, his partner escapes. Like, the secret team goes in. They find like William Covey's name in it. Frank Nugent's pocket, whatever. I think that was because they didn't like Covey.
And this is like five years after he testifies during the church committee hearings, and he spills.
Yeah, he revealed the family jewels, and they thought it was like he told way too much. Even though it was really a super good cover up on Covey's part. It was like a excellent limited hangout. But
yeah.
Appreciate that.
but so stick it to him. They put his card just so he gets in a lot of bad press or something in the guy's body.
Yeah, there was a feud between Kobe and Helms or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And I guess there was, because he seceded Helms, that's right. It was Helms, I guess it was Nixon's conflict with Helms, which I think you could argue led to Watergate, because, you know, the first whiff of that I got was when I read Russ Baker's book, the Bush dynasty, although it's worth, about so much more than just the Bush dynasty, but the whole intrigues of Watergate and the Kennedy assassination. And again, if you read that book,
high on my reading list, but I haven't gotten to it yet.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, yeah.
I've heard like a 10-hour interview with Russ Baker that's talked about a lot of it.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I also believe that, yeah, Nixon was brought down by the CIA, who intentionally got caught. So that they could, like, basically bring him down, because he was doing, he recognized China, he was doing detente, and they were like, we need to get rid of this guy. Plus, he was messing with the CIA and messing with the drug routes and stuff like that.
Yeah, and he thought he was president, I guess, and that's
any president thinks that they can, like, single-handedly run foreign policy is not going to come to a good end. Or anyone, there's that whole period between 1960 and 1980 where all, like, Kennedy's killed, LBJ has to resign early, Nixon is brought down by Watergate. Ford only gets one term. Carter's taken down by Stackley and Bush. And then with Reagan, it's like they decide never to mess with the CIA again. And after that, it's just sort of like there's no more scandals or investigations. It's just sort of like they get away with it from then on.
Well, yeah, well, Reagan happened to be...
I mean, there is the scandal of Iran-Contra, but they decide, you know, not to, like, make it into a Watergate.
And that's right, yeah.
Get away with it.
And, of course, Reagan happens to be shot by a, you know...
And everyone at the time's like, if we don't get these covert operations under control, like, our, you know, our whole country is going to be screwed. There's going to be a huge bloodbath. Like, you read what they're saying at the time of Iran-Contra, and it's just like, it was totally true because, like, they didn't fix it, and then 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, and then they put in all the plans that they had during the Reagan era for, like, mass surveillance and detention without warrant and all that stuff, and they just, they passed it all, and now we live in that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The world.
There was, what, the Rex 84 or something that was revealed when, I think it was Jack Brooks of Texas, kind of naive.
Well, that was, yeah, that was part of it, the plan to, like, round up all the immigrants and lock them in camps or whatever, and possibly peace protesters, too, in the event of a war on Nicaragua, which they were planning to have happen. It was like, yeah, that was, it was this false flag operation that they were planning to use to justify the war in Nicaragua that actually caused the CNN investigation, because first they killed this Contra leader, Eden Pastor, with a bomb, and they tried to blame it on the Sandinistas, and then they were going to plan to kill the American ambassador, Louis Tams, and then they were going to use that to as the excuse to invade Nicaragua, but it was all like exposed.
Well, it kind of shows you how bad things have gotten since then, because at least there was some resistance.
Yeah, the Iran-Contra scandal was like sort of like the last gasp of any kind of like criticism of like just like blatant imperialism. Like now the Democrats are, you know, they're just lockstep with the Republicans. They're not like, we need to stop doing this. They're just like, we need to do more. Like,
Now, as far as Shackley goes, in the 70s, the Vietnam War ends, Nguyen Bank is shut down, you know, Bill Colby's name is mentioned in the press.
Well, like Nguyen it was going between 75 and 88. It was financing all these scandalous things, like in Iran and in Central America and, you know.
Okay, this would have been – so now we have a situation – it's kind of the late 70s. Vietnam War is
and
over.
In Afghanistan, no doubt, yeah.
Yeah, and 78, 79. Now, of course, with the election, as far as Shackley's career goes, he comes back in the 70s, and he is sort of I guess he's eyeing the directorship of the CIA because his friend George Bush is there. He's ensconced in there in 76 under Ford. But then Carter wins the election in 76. And
yeah, that's like a disaster for Bush and Shackley. Like Bush as Russ Baker, or like as he said in the interview, he's like, Bush begged Carter to let him stay on as the CIA director. And Carter's like, no.
Uh-huh.
And Carter wanted to reform the CIA, and it damaged Shackley's career. He wasn't actually fired. He later quit, but he was like, when Bush was DCI, Shackley had been director of all covert operations.
Uh-huh.
He was the assistant officially, but like his boss is more of a figurehead. And all these terrorist attacks happen. Like, they blow up this Cuban airliner, kill 73 people. They, like, kill Orlando Letelier in downtown Washington, D.C.
That's right. The car blows up and kills Ronnie Moffat, the girl, the woman. And no one's ever tried for it. This is all part of Condor, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which it involved with, like, the coup that Shackley had set up in Chile.
Mm-hmm. And now, so the Nguyen Han is funding these type of operations, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so that's the money for it. Now, this is the in 70s. So in the late 70s, Shackley's kind of brushed aside in CIA. He decides to, quote, retire and pursue life in the private sector. This brings in the era of this is the Safari Club, because this is after the Church Committee hearings and the Rockefeller Committee hearings. And so the CIA's got a lot of bad press, and supposedly they've been neutered. They can't do as much as they used to do, so they got to do things under the cover. So this organization, this private intelligence network opens up, because all these – well, Saturday Night Massacre, the October Halloween Massacre, they call it, when Carter fired all these guys, hundreds of these agents. And so yeah. They're not going to go quietly into the night, you know. And so they kind of regroup and they form this private club with other countries like Saudi Arabia, South Africa. It's called the Safari Club because they meet in Africa, I guess. And they decide to conduct their own intelligence. And this is sort of the basis for what we see now is sort of a private intelligence network that's even more out of control, well, I guess.
Yeah, like Safari Club is one of two separate things. It's a huge private off the books CIA that's like loyal to George Bush mm-hmm. that Shackley is running, and then also Shackley is also running the Safari as part of that. Shackley is also the liaison to the Safari Club, which is America's alliance with France, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Egypt, Morocco, and Iran before the Shah falls. And the actually how the Safari Club, the Al Qaeda, is originated.
Okay, yeah, in Afghanistan.
Yeah, because the first thing they do is they fund like the war in Angola illegally because like Congress had cut off funding for that, and then they move over to into funding Afghanistan, like 78, I think is when the destabilization really began, and then by 79, Carter had authorized it, but it had begun 2 years earlier. Then, like, they basically provoked the Soviets into invading. And then,
yes, yeah, and of course that's another Polish national, right, or Polish ethnic Pole.
The new Brzezinski, who had been recruited in the CIA by 60s, is now like risen to become like. Like a Kissinger level type person planning American strategy.
Who I guess you could say who all work for the Rockefellers.
Yeah, they both work for the Rockefellers.
Yeah, so here we are in the late 70s, and I think what I gather from your interviews and what I've read is you tend to look at the you have Carter, and you have the Iranian Revolution, and Khomeini comes to power, the Shah abdicates, flees the country. And in your research, you seem to say that the CIA, or at least elements therein, Shackley's gang, set Carter up with that.
Yeah, basically, there's this Iranian researcher called Farah Mansour, who did a bunch of he totally forced me to like rethink the whole Iran revolution, which is after they overthrew the Shah. It wasn't inevitable that Khomeini would come to power, mm-hmm. and the CIA chose Khomeini to come to power. Like what they'll say during the normal thing is they stop paying these mullahs on behalf of the CIA, but actually what they start paying them to overthrow the government instead of support the Shah,
mm-hmm.
and then the Shah's overthrown and they bring Khomeini in, and then there's like that's called the deep box over surprise.
Yes.
And then after that, they make a secret deal. After the hostage crisis, they make a secret deal with the Iranians, and this is definitely confirmed, where they just agreed to hold on to the hostages so Carter would lose the election, and then they actually didn't release them until Inauguration Day. And people, for some reason, didn't find that suspicious. It's like on the exact day of Inauguration, they released them because of the secret deal. It wasn't until Iran-Contra was exposed that people started, like, look into this.
Mm-hmm. This is where Casey and Bush flew to France, I think, and met with the Iranians and I guess the Israelis were part of this and transferring the weaponry, because the backdrop of this is also the Iraqi-Iranian war, which the U.S. played a big part in fomenting, correct?
Yeah, and obviously like it's related to the Safari Club, because it's like Iran and Israel were part of that,
mm-hmm.
and the Egyptian arms deals, and it's all one big arms trafficking network. So like all these different wars, and then so they start selling arms to Iran and Iraq at the same time.
Uh huh. And at the same time, of course, we had to take a couple steps back. This is the 78 Accords with Israel and Egypt set up this this funding of weaponry and subsidies, which Ed Wilson went into business with his company Eastco, but he thought he was working for the CIA because he was working with Shackley and Kleins, but never got it in writing. So he got caught like smuggling explosives to Libya, right? Which he went to prison for.
Yeah, he got framed for being like a rogue CIA agent.
Yeah,
because he Wilson had become like super rich or whatever by running CIA front companies, and like Shackley had asked him for a $100,000 loan that, like, he was just made clear that he wasn't ever going to pay it back. It's like one of these things these crooked people do is they give each other fake loans and stuff. And
yes.
If you know Daniel Hapsaker's work, you've heard about stuff like that where they'll just give someone $1 million loan that's never paid back.
Uh-huh.
But anyways, Shackley asked for this $100,000 loan because, like, Wilson had given a loan like that to his underling clients, and, like, he turned down Shackley, so they decided to, like, take his business and, like, frame him for as being a rogue CIA agent. And he ended up in jail for, like, decades when he was spying for the CIA, and they told everybody that he wasn't working for the CIA.
And their man in Egypt was Mubarak, right?
Well, yes. Sadat was assassinated as part of this East Coast thing. They trained Sadat's security force, and then the security force assassinates them. And Mubarak takes over, and he was one of the ones that's, like, he was handling bribing everybody for Itzko, so he was, like, a partner in this.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, the rise of Mubarak is part of this. And with Nugent Hand, you should also mention that they brought down the Australian Prime Minister earlier.
Oh, that's right. Like, Whitten or something?
Coup.
Was his name Whitley or Whitten?
Whitlam,
yeah. And, I think that factors in the movie The Falcon and the Snowman. I think that's part of the...
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but I want to.
I think he's getting. They're getting.
That's what inspired the guy to turn traitor. Was when he found out like what they were up to in Australia.
Yeah, according to the movie, that's what happened. I remember seeing that he's getting the cables, and you know, he gets disillusioned. At least that's how the movie handles. I'm not sure if that's a true story or not, but that's supposedly, you know, whatever. That's how Hollywood treated it, at least. But now of course back to now we're. I just want that now. So we're dealing with a 78. I guess it's was it the fall of 78? Is that when the Shah abdicates, and there's a January 79 when the Khomeini comes to the power. I'm not sure the time frame there, but roughly around that 78-79 time frame.
Yeah.
But you're saying is that Khomeini, the revolution itself was something that at least elements within the CIA or the American power structure wanted. They desired a revolution and they desired Khomeini to come into power.
Well, like, yeah, they found out the Shah was dying in 1975, so they knew he was going to fall, contrary to popular belief. And they preferred, Khomeini was at least anti-communist to, like, possibly a communist Iran or, like, a nationalist Iran. And so it's better to have someone, like, who talks tough and, like, you know, but won't work with the Russians. Like, after Khomeini came to power, they gave him a list of all the communists in Iran, and Khomeini killed them all. And then he said, I received a message from Allah. So, like, usually for public consumption, he's calling America the great Satan, but then when the CIA gives him a death list, all of a sudden they calls him a message from Allah.
Now, okay, so this is their way of sort of controlling the situation in Iran.
And again, it brings down Carter. It makes it look like... It makes him look weak and terrible. Yeah. He had no idea what was going on, and helped Reagan get into office.
Of course, with the hostage crisis. Now, there's another, because it was. I think it was Kissinger who convinced Carter to take the Shah in. Remember, I think, when he was going from country to country.
Yeah, like on behalf of the Rockefellers. And the Rockefeller Bank was actually used to pay off the Iranians. They financed the arms deal, like I found out through BCCI.
Really? Chase Manhattan Bank was involved in that?
Yeah.
And also Chase Manhattan Bank also benefited greatly from the hostage seizure.
Because they froze the Iranian money that like Chase Manhattan Bank this bank was holding, which is all the Shah's money, so they got to like keep it basically for like decades.
So, I mean, that's... it makes you rethink the whole thing. And if you don't think they're above doing that, they've done far worse than making hostages have to cool their heels for extra 60, 120 days, whatever it takes to make sure
they use these same Iranian fundamentals to bring down Mossadegh back in 1954. Like, so it's not that far out of it. Like obviously they work with Al Qaeda now. So
that's right.
Iranians are way nicer than them. So. Mm-hmm. Not surprising at all.
And you have this 8-year war between Iran and Iraq, and what this does is this puts Iraq in the debt, borrowing money from the Western banks to pay for this war, and also from the Gulf states, which I guess provides the pretext for the 1990 Gulf War, because the dispute between Kuwait and
That was masterminded by Bush, because he basically told Saddam, like, I don't care if you invade Kuwait. And then once he invades Kuwait, he, like, you know, that's where the term New World Order comes out of. You know, it's like, we need to create this. We can't allow any country to invade another country. Ironically, it's like Iraq. It's like the poster child for this. And then, like, you know, like, they get this huge international coalition, like the whole world, even Russia is united under American leadership. And it's like, we have entered, like, World War IV, which is what I call, like, the post-Cold War era.
Uh-huh.
Endless wars that we're still involved in now.
Oh, man. So,
Bush told him to invade, and it was all, the whole thing was manipulated. And, like, Brzezinski was the one who told Saddam to invade Iran in 1980.
That's right.
So, like, the whole thing was manipulated.
So, now, we have... Shackley, working for Bush and all this, and he also has connections to Donald Gregg.
Yeah, Donald Gregg had worked under Shackley in Vietnam, okay. Where, like, Felix Rodriguez had worked for Donald Gregg, who was one of the infamous Cuban terrorists who's most famous for being there. The murder of Che Guevara,
and
as well as, like, a huge Iran Contra figure.
Yeah, because his name came up. I was in some of these Henry Vincent's book about the DC Madam, a call boy operation, and he was the one caught using a credit card at his mortuary services, which is really a cover for a call boy operation. Donald Gregg.
Oh, interesting.
And,
yeah, I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah, and this is what some of these, because this, what's weird is this is this.
Well, you know, they say about Bush and
yeah,
and this, like, Gregg was, like, his national security advisor's right hand man.
Yeah, so. And also ambassador to South Korea.
I think. In that kind of thing.
Yeah, was he also involved in South Korea? He was the ambassador of South Korea, I think. But he's also also CIA hand. But I'm saying this is how we get into some of these weirder, some of the more disturbing scandals, or the Franklin scandal, because. John DeCamp, he was a legislator in Nebraska who spearheaded that investigation. He was good friends with Bill Colby. And Bill Colby, in that book, DeCamp's book, Bill Colby, when he's investigating this stuff, and Bill Colby seems to be wise to it, kind of knows what's kind of going on. And he told DeCamp, according to DeCamp, they sat, you know, at 2 a.m. one morning having coffee in their kitchen talking about these things. He told Camp, he said, there's some things that you can't stop or do anything about, and this is one of them. Stop your investigation. Of course, the chief investigator's plane blew up, Gary Caradore, and said he had the goods on it. But this links back to the White House, Washington, Bush, Donald Gregg, but the investigation was then quashed. But this also links to Robert Gray, who was the, you know, the Hill and Knowlton guy.
Interesting. Robert Keith Gray is one of these, like, fascinating power player. Like, these are, like, the fixtures behind the scenes.
Yeah,
like, really.
He was very...
People like him, Irving Davidson, William Pauley. Those are people who we're looking at. Very fascinating.
But he was blackmailed. He was, because he was big in, like, conservative Republican circles.
Oh, yeah, he was gay.
He was homosexual. And so he was blackmailed. It was funny because his outfit, Hill and Knowlton, played a big role in promoting the Gulf War, the first Gulf War.
Yeah, the PR firm. Incubator. But, yeah, they're the ones that trained that girl to, like, how to lie to the world about incubator babies.
Yeah, the ambassador, the Kuwaiti ambassador.
The ambassador's daughter. They pretend it was just some random girl. Yeah, Shackley actually had this big deal. Like, through Bush, he got this $21 million contract to build a warehouse in Kuwait during the 80s. It was, like, an interesting connection.
So this was probably Shackley got used to living.
As one of his rewards.
Living like a prince in Vietnam, driving, you know, chauffeur, limousine, living in a palace, and then comes back home. So
he decides he has to be rich now. Before that, he was, like, I think it was sort of, like, up until the 70s, he was more motivated just by, like, he wanted to become director and, like, you know, he was a true believer, but then he becomes more and more, like, greedy, and he wants to make, like, a fortune, and he did make a fortune.
Well, this has to happen, because if you're, like, one of these guys, you're watching, you know, all this cash and all these drugs go in and out, you know, and watching everyone else get rich doing it. Psychologically, it can be very, you know, straining on you because you figure, well, what about my retirement, right? And cops make this, you know, crooked cops make this rationalization all the time, you know. all this cash and just goes, and what if I just steal a little bit here and there and that sort of thing? And, you know, considering that the whole drug war is a fraud anyway, you know, why? It's easy to rationalize, you know, these things. But, of course, getting into Iran-Contra, some of these scandals, you mentioned Shackley is involved in some of these scandals we don't really hear about. We mentioned, of course, you mentioned the Nugent Hand Bank. That it goes, you know, how it was involved in funding some of these dirty operations around the world, some, you know, paying for some of these black ops or civil wars, whether it's in, you know, Africa or in Central America. His role in Iran-Contra. Now, most people think... Most
basically
think,
all...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
He was like the central figure in the Iran-Contra scandal because all like the people involved were all like what Daniel Jiang called the secret team. Like, they're all Shackley's friends, like Felix Rodriguez, Thomas Klein, and like it had all evolved out of like the East Coast thing. It was like basically the company that Ed Wilson financed with his money that they cheated him out of. It was like what became known as the Enterprise, which is like this privatized, deniable military arms and drugs trafficking network.
And that's what exactly what Oliver North called it, right? He called it the Enterprise, an off-the-shelf, books. Of course, when what we watched in the summer of 87, we heard about Contras and weapons and neat ideas, like as Oliver North referred to it. But we didn't hear much about the drug angle of it, because that was later exposed by Gary Webb, right? Who's career didn't turn out too well.
It was known in the press at the time, but it was like they refused to cover it in Congress at all. There was a famous incident where two people were in there, and it was like they held up a sign and said, "Ask about the cocaine, ask about the cocaine." Those people were sent to jail for a year.
A year? Really?
Yeah.
A year in prison for doing
that. They locked them up, and they didn't lock anybody who was dealing the drugs, of course. Meanwhile, of course, you know, they lock up like 500,000. I think in the 80s, they'd only locked up for 500,000 black people for, you know, having a gram of cocaine while, like, they're, like, flying tons of it. It's just, like, so sick.
Well, the prison industrial complex needs those bodies to, you know.
Yeah, it's all part of that. And slave labor.
Slave labor, filling the cells to meet the contracts, and this, you know, Correction Corporation of America. That's all part of course, that, you know, that's the Bill Clinton was reinventing government and all that back in the 90s was a big part of that.
With Bill Clinton, they like the handle rose to like 2 million from like the 500,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And I heard it's that it was like, I think of the price per inmate went from like $8,000 to $24,000. Or maybe, I think maybe like even $100,000 or some huge amount. It's a big, you know, embezzlement, you know, wealth transfer, you know, scheme. Like, it's like a, you know, like, I guess like padding contracts for defense contracts. It's, you know.
Yeah, it's like all the industries that close down, they give those people jobs, like, they give the fired white workers jobs, like, locking up all, like, the minorities.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's keeping middle America going.
Yeah, you got to build another prison somewhere for the jobs. That's great. It's a great growth model you got there. Now, because the idea was in Iran-Contra, the weapons were being shipped down to Central America. And of course, planes come back. They don't come back empty, do they? And they would be. It was, from what I understand, at least a big part of the operation was planes being flown into an airport in Mena, Arkansas, where they had a very compliant governor there who took his cut. We went into the Arkansas Development Corporation, you know. But somehow a lot of the cocaine found its way into.
I've got a great story about the Mena thing.
Oh, like, go ahead.
Tien went to Bill Clinton and told him all the details about like Mena and stuff. And then because he had so much information, he went to this other guy who's like blackmailed him. Basically, it's like, I'll cover up Mena if you let me be president. It's like, that's how he became the president.
That's great. Oh, okay. Made his deal. Okay. This fueled the cocaine, the crack epidemic of the 80s and early 90s. Which Gary Webb exposed in his series, in San Jose Mercury News, a Dark Alliance series. and then he was hounded from journalism for it.
Well, obviously, yeah, it's totally disgusting because, like I said, it was exposed at the time. Like Ira Perry, for instance, had exposed it, and I'm obsessed with Irene Katra, so I read like the main book from the '80s, Out of Control, and they go into it completely. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's like Leslie Cockburn, so it's not even just like Rob Perry's kind of a rogue journalist.
Yeah, yeah.
And then so it's like they knew about it, and of course they knew about Alfred McCoy had written his book in the '70s, and they knew about all that.
Well, he was chased out.
They knew about the mafia. They knew all of it. And, like, the Cubans had been busted dealing a massive drug ring in the '70s called. In a DA operation called Operation Eagle. So they knew that the Cubans were a huge drug-dealing army. And yet, despite the fact that they knew this whole 50-year history of CIA drug involvement, they decided to destroy Gary Webb's career and act like he was insane for telling what everybody already had known by the 90s.
Yeah. Well, at least those who bothered to read those books and articles, yeah. Because if it's not...
Well, yeah, well, like, yeah. Researchers. But, like, I mean, the media could have... What I'm saying is, like, you know...
Yeah, the media was doing his
job.
All
the information was out there in the public record and stuff by the time he revealed it, and, like, they still destroyed his career, even though it wasn't that far-fetched at all, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, the evening news is supposed to kind of distill this information, collate it, and provide you a package so you have a general idea of what's going on in the world. But we both know that's not what the media is for.
Well, yeah. All, like, the big networks were founded by these OSS... information warfare specialists from World War II or whatever, like C.D. Jackson, Belousis, Catherine Graham. All these people are, like, so in bed with the CIA.
Yeah, way in parallel.
So, like, give speeches like, America doesn't... We know that America doesn't need... Americans don't need to know the truth, and we will always keep your secrets and stuff like that. They'll, like, openly make speeches like that. It's hilarious.
Mm-hmm. This is why they don't get the information. And it goes to even the... I just finished a book... Oh, what's his name? It's called Science of Coercion. Science of Coercion,
yeah,
the book. Did you read that?
That's the book I'm talking about, yeah.
Oh, okay,
Christopher Simpson's awesome.
Christopher Simpson, yeah. And the whole study of mass communication, it wasn't an academic, you know, sort of an academic, disinterested study of how societies communicate using technology, developing mass communication. The whole study of mass communication was there for psychological warfare, for manipulation.
Yeah, and that's just like everybody, whether they're like Mockingbird or not, they're trained. Everybody who goes into journalism goes to communication studies, and they're just like trained in the science developed by these psychological warfare specialists. So their whole view of what the press should be is psychological warfare, basically. Yeah. All they want to know is how effective are they in convincing people of the message, that, like, is this true?
Mm-hmm. Which is why someone like Doug Valentine is so valuable.
Absolutely. Yeah, and because... he helped out, like, a nobody like me on my Ted Shackley article. He's just, like, not only is he a great researcher, he's just, like, a great guy in general.
Oh, he is. I've had the pleasure of interviewing him a couple times, just communicating with him. And he's just, a college dropout. You know, when he was younger, he was a tree surgeon, you know, guy working, but he just has this, you know, a talent for writing and research. And since he developed this outside the normal channels, the controlled channels, the, you know, Columbia School of Journalism and stuff, you know, and his story about how he came to write a book about the Phoenix Project, you know, his approach to, you know, asking questions and how they liked them, they got all this information. And because of that, he was able to get a better view of the whole program than the actual people who actually, you know, ran it. Because
People should go out and listen to the tapes they put online of all of the Phoenix program interviews, and he's just like, because I wouldn't have the guts to, like, try to con my way into the CIA's confidence. So you could sort of be a fly on the wall and just, like, listen to everything they said to him. It's really interesting to see the mentality of these CIA guys.
Yeah, and it's almost like... I mean, we're talking about Shackley, and we talk about his upbringing and how he was incorporated into this world. If you, at a young age, are brought into that world, I can almost understand, you know, because it's almost like this view of the world, or this crackpot view of the world. You have to be a pirate. You have to be a rogue. You have to break. You can't have the luxury of morality. You have to, you know, because it's just the way the world works.
It's a famous quote. By George White, like, where else can an all-American boy lie, cheat, steal? All in the Name of the Almighty or something like that.
Yes, George Hunter White.
CIA,
yeah.
You can be a gangster and you won't get busted no matter what you do, pretty much. Unless you piss off somebody else in the CIA, like Ed Wilson did.
And you can see, that's why it's articles like yours and when people do, when they focus on a particular person or personality in their career, it tells us a lot, because if you focus on a Ted Shackley or a Clark Clifford, you know, or a George Bush for that matter, or a family, you know, you can
learn the whole history of America.
Yeah, exactly. The secret history of America. But it gets an understanding of how it can, you know, how it happens, you know, how they can turn out this way. It's one of these things where, you have Shackley, who's, you know, kind of a broken family. He gets brought into this stuff. All of a sudden he transcends normal life in his life. He can break all the rules. It's almost like that scene where Henry Hill in Goodfellas is saying, you know, we didn't pay any taxes. We weren't some, you know, slob working on a paycheck. We never paid income tax. We never had Social Security. Now the rules didn't apply to us. And that's the same how these people may view the world. Something like a Frank Sturgis. Or
that's really how they view the world. It's sort of like if a cop comes to the mafia guy, is like, I mean, what do you think you're doing? Like, don't you know how this works? Like, the mayor's in my pocket. Like,
yes.
How dare you harass me?
Yeah.
And that's like how the CIA is. If like anybody would dare, like any the Justice Department or the FBI, it's like you're way below us. Like, how dare you even think about investigating us?
E. Howard Hunt's another example. You know. Sort of a
it's like when they get in trouble, it's like, well, you better let me go or I'm going to start talking about all this stuff I know.
Mm-hmm.
So Nixon's like, oh, we better pay off E. Howard Hunt, or he's going to start talking about the JFK assassination.
And some say that's why his wife.
I don't know if he was really involved. Like, his confession is super fishy or whatever. But
I know. It's another thing. They're all liars, right? I mean, you can't.
Yeah.
Just like when Shackler or David Sanchez Morales says something, he says, yeah, it could be true. I can see it happening, you know.
Maybe Morales, Shackley, I wouldn't trust. Like, he's just like, he will not tell you anything.
Yeah.
Except what you already know, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, he was very secretive. Like, a lot of these CIA guys are alcoholics. They'll just, like, blab, like Morales did.
Of course,
he said, like, I was there when we killed that MF for JFK, and that little, I was in L.A. when they killed the little bastard RFK.
Yeah.
He, like, openly bragged about his role. He was like another one of Shackley's right hand men, and he.
And Chris, but it's almost like it's a cautionary tale too, because, you know, a lot of them end up dead. I mean, if you look at in the 70s, what was it during the House subcommittee hearings on the assassinations? You had this flurry of deaths that occurred. Heart attacks here. Of course, who was it? Johnny Roselli ends up cut up in a, you know, put in a.
Well, yeah, a lot of these people were killed by Shackley's operation, basically to cover up the Iran-Contra affair and all the others, Watergate and before that, JFK, whatever. But yeah, like when Shackley was in charge of all the covert operations was when Johnny Roselli was chopped up. Although it was like Santos Trafficante that probably killed him.
Actually did it, yeah. But also didn't Giancano also get shot during that time? And
yeah, he got shot in the mouth like 7 times.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you shouldn't like to say don't talk.
Mm-hmm.
While he was being guarded, it's so hilarious. Like, he was being guarded 24 hours a day, but he still managed to get assassinated. Nobody got in trouble for that one.
And it was, David Sanchez Morales, I think, died of a heart attack in that time frame, I think, too. And William King Harvey died, too, of a heart attack. Now, you know, that could be natural. But, I mean, during the church committee hearings, remember that you had the heart attack gun. Remember that scene?
Yeah. Shackley was in charge of managing the whole, like, cover-up of the church committee. Even though it's, like, so famous, it's like, all these people on the committee were, like, there basically to, like, protect the CIA.
And yes.
Not church or whatever, but a lot of these guys. And they make speeches like, you know, I just want to say how great the CIA is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Rockefeller Committee investigators, any committee investigative.
That was like a super cover-up one.
Yeah, I know, Rockefeller. Jeez. The CIA works for the Rockefellers. Come on.
You know? Yeah, Reagan now, was on that one.
As so Shackley, I mean, so he died in 2002, 2003?
It was, yeah, 2002.
2002. Yet he cast a long shadow into the 21st century because what we're dealing with today is, I think you mentioned the article where the reforms that were implemented after September 11, 2001, creation of the Director of National Intelligence, that was a Shackley plan, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a Shackley event. He'd written his paper about it in the 90s, how we needed to have a Director of National Intelligence, and then they put that in like 4 years after he died.
Mm-hmm.
And actually created it. Yeah, he also wanted to rename the CIA. They haven't done that yet, though. Change the name. Like, if you have a scandal, just change the name, like Blackwater did. That's what, like, most intelligence agencies do. The CIA is, like, I guess, they don't care.
Just change the name on it. Like,
we don't have to change our name. Like,
yeah, they actually named, I'm thinking about, you know, you have George Bush, who was a director for, I think, less than a year, and they named the headquarters after
he was
him.
A lifelong CIA guy.
I know.
Well, I guess you know you either rest take it, but
it's like now hit like, that.
I thought that they met when Shackley was in charge of Far East operations and Bush was the ambassador, but then I was realizing no, this goes back to Miami because like Bush was so involved
right.
in like Bay of Pigs and all this stuff. So.
That's right. He was handling all the Cubans, managing all the Cubans down there, from what I understand. These are according to Russ Baker, yeah. And what were the ships down there during the Bay of Pigs? It was the Barbara and the Houston or something like that.
Yeah, it was all these different companies and family members of Bush that named like the ships for the Bay of Pigs invasion after.
Uh-huh.
Which that was done in the 80s. That was what maybe even before I heard about this. Maybe know that Bush was CIA.
Yeah, well, I mean the fact that
headquarters after him.
Yeah, and of course first I learned about it was that he didn't know where he was when Kennedy was. He didn't remember where he was when Kennedy was assassinated.
There's only two people that don't remember where they were when Kennedy died: Bush and Nixon.
And they both were in Dallas, right?
Yeah, they were both in Dallas.
I mean, it's
amazing. Yeah, like you have all these presidents there, like just mysteriously there to like witness this event.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and there I think it was a. Nixon was at some sort of a bottling convention or something?
Nixon was meeting with, like, the people that were involved in it, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that meet, yeah. But,
PepsiCo is, like, PepsiCo has been used as a cover for drug, like, smuggling the chemicals they need to, like, turn drugs into, like, you know, turn coca leaf into cocaine or heroin and stuff.
Yeah, wasn't there also bottling?
PepsiCo bottling company was involved in, like, this drug... in the heroin trade in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And then, like,
yeah.
Coca-Cola was involved with, like, all their Iran-Contra stuff. And obviously, Coca-Cola used to have cocaine in it.
Yeah. Well, relationship between corporations and the central, you know, intelligence agencies is longstanding because, of course, it was the banking and finance which created the intelligence agencies to do their work for them. CIA is an agency, and they act on behalf of somebody, and that somebody is, you know, the City of London or Wall Street or the banks.
Yeah, basically, even before there was a CIA, it was sort of like the Wall Street people did it on their own. Like, they just did it. They were the ones, you know, manipulating everything, and they mm-hmm. just did it privately. Mm-hmm. Or they were sending the Marines, possibly.
Yeah, like Smedley Butler said, you know, I was a muscle
boy. When they made Donovan close down the OSS, he opened this mysterious World Finance Corporation. So it's sort of like a precursor to like when Shackley got kicked out of the CIA all those years later, he opened his privatized CIA.
And you could, yeah, so that, yeah, they're doing all the bidding of for these corporations around them. Now we have we have NGOs and things like that, like National Endowment for Democracy or Open Society Foundation, these things that do the work, or USAID. USAID has always been a front, right? I mean, that's a...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the National Endowment for Democracy, it's like one of the things the CIA guy pulled up Valentine's, like, the CIA tests out these programs, and then once they figure out it works, they can just, like, have it overtly, like, turn it over to the military or create, like, the NAD just created to do, like, the stuff the CIA used to do.
Mm-hmm.
And just do it openly, and then say, it's democracy. Like, because, of course, we have a right to, like, funnel money into elections all over the planet and, like, create political parties of our sole government. It's like, it's just democracy.
Yeah, what, Victoria Nuland handing out cookies in Ukraine or something?
Yeah, well, like, yeah, they spent $5 billion there.
$5 billion cookies?
They have organizations.
Yeah. At the same time, Joe Biden's son is negotiating energy deals.
They put Joe Biden's son on the board of directors of this gas company, but unfortunately, it was destroyed by, like, I imagine, because, like, they sent all the oil prices falling to, like, try to mess with Russia. And so, those Iranian fracking schemes are worth much right now.
In
the future, they will be again, probably, I'm sure.
Well, that's all part of weakening the whole war on Russia, I guess you could say, doing indirectly.
That's actually,
press war.
That's one of the ways they brought down the Soviet Union, too, was they manipulated the oil prices in the 80s.
That's right.
That's one of the reasons Saddam was forced to invade, because they were intentionally sending the oil prices falling, and it was, like, hurting him. That's why he wanted.
And the skyrocketing oil prices of the 70s also was a way to impoverish the Third World. It's Kissinger's plan.
That's a good example because, like, people think that, like, the Iranian they intentionally cut off the oil to, like, the private corporations cut off the oil supply to America. It wasn't that they ran out of oil and they caused that whole gasoline shortage crisis during the Carter year. And it was just totally manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
And they totally got away with it. And people still think it's, like, the Iranians' fault. Well, it wasn't. The Iranians were actually selling more oil than ever.
Yeah,
importing it, selling it abroad, and stuff like that.
There was a, I forget who asked, went to the Shah. Was it the Shah in the late 70s before he fall? And they asked him, this is during OPEC embargo. I forget, was it the 70s? Maybe in the mid 70s.
Yeah, there was an earlier, earlier oil shortage with Kissinger, where Kissinger went to.
Well, that was the Yom Kippur War.
Saudis.
Yeah, the Yom Kippur War.
Agree.
Yeah. There was the Yom Kippur War, which is kind of fomented by Kissinger. And this was the pretext, because then OPEC would put the embargo on for the oil prices to rise 400%, and this kind of made a lot of the Western oil companies' ventures profitable, right? Like the North Sea and also the Alaskan pipeline deal. At the same time, it enabled the oil company kind of to ride the inflationary wave that was inevitable from the closing of the gold window in 71. And this this creates the petrodollar system.
Saudi's the money on the military.
Yeah, exactly.
American weapons. So it all goes back to America.
It goes to the banks. And, of course, all the money goes in the U.S. banks, and they buy U.S. treasuries, and it all gets recycled. I mean, it's oh, man. The most sinister part of that was in Kissinger when he wrote that National Security Study Memorandum 200, and he talked about this was using food and energy as a weapon against the poor of the Third World. To cut their population. He called for the doubling of the death rate by the year 2000 in order to lower their population and therefore make their resources more available to Western corporations.
Yeah, of course, because they're the famous as one of those, like, evil, notorious war criminals on the planet. He's currently advising Donald Trump on what to do.
Of course, we mentioned Castle Bank and Mary Carter Paint Company and Resorts International. Of course, we get the Resorts International, we get the Donald Trump and Roy Cohn and all that. So,
oh yeah,
they're all connected. But then you're getting in the different factions of the ruling of the global elite, and you have a more nationalist faction perhaps, which Donald Trump may represent. You have the transnational internationalist faction, more like perhaps the Rockefellers or the. Or I don't know, family, but maybe the Clinton end of it. And I think you said in one of these, in last election, Donald Trump was probably the less dangerous candidate. And I think you're probably...
Well, that's because Hillary was like, I want to start World War. Yeah. We need to start shooting Russian planes down and, like, establish a no-fly zone immediately. It was just like her plan would have brought the world to the brink of World War III. But obviously, Donald Trump's pretty disastrous, too. Yeah. He's like... he's not an isolationist at all. It's like Reagan reborn, where it's like, we need to, like, double the defense budget.
Well, I know.
We already spent 10 times more than every other country on the planet on weapons. We need to, like, keep increasing this? No.
I know.
And it's like,
double the defense budget.
War on immigrants and stuff. So yeah. Within like a week of me saying that, it was like, oh, my God. He's really going to this is going to be like a terrible 4 years.
Anyway, it's hard. I mean, it's hard. I don't really look at electoral politics. I believe largely.
Yeah, I'm like also. I'm too political to follow politics, basically.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of how do you? I mean, you do research like yours, and you know, you get into this stuff. And how do you get too excited about electoral politics? I mean, you know,
well, especially like the last election. Yeah. Like, which do you want to be shot or burned alive? Or those are your choices.
I do think electoral politics. Yeah, it's stage managed. But by watching the play on stage, you may get a glimpse into the mind of the playwright. And so, I mean, it does serve some function. We're seeing some sort of in this election. I think we saw maybe two contending factions of this elite going at this is why Donald Trump was allowed to run and win, you know.
Well, I think it was like the Clintons are like, yeah, we'll get this guy because it's like he'll make us look good, and then the whole thing backfired.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's what I thought that he was put up there to ensure Hillary's victory. But it looks like elements within the now openly acknowledged deep state, which never used to exist. Only people like Peter Dale Scott talked about the deep state. Now I'm watching it talked about like on the evening news or something. Like, what is this? Revelation of the method, huh?
Yeah, basically it's all become.
I
even saw they were like talking about like Donald Trump's mafia things. It's like, why did you bring this up during the election? I mean, his past is so scandalous. But yeah, of course, instead of focusing on all the stuff they could prove, instead they're going with this crazy, the Russians did it, like, liberals will hate Russia for all time now, and the success of this Cold War 2.0 will be guaranteed, and hundreds of billions of dollars will be wasted.
Yep.
And hopefully the world will survive, and we won't have a nuclear war, but they seem very intent on trying to provoke one. It's crazy. It's like either in the South China Sea or Ukraine or Syria. They'd love to be on the brink of total disaster.
Imagine the U.S. accusing Russia of manipulating a foreign government's election.
Well, yeah, we bragged about the fact that we, like, helped Yeltsin steal, like, the 96 election. We were, like, bragging about it in Newsweek. It's, like, on the front cover, America to the rescue.
Yeah.
Well, that's the, you know, when we do it, we're just helping democracy.
Yeah.
Be more democratic by buying off politicians and launching propaganda campaigns. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the whole thing about, it's like when we invade, we're liberating, right? And
yes, of course. You know, we've liberated Iraq by occupying it, mm-hmm. invading.
So
now we have peacekeepers to like. We need to send in peacekeepers, and we need to like declare a no-fly zone so we could bomb the whole country in the smithereens. Like, it's all very. Well, I don't like. I hate Orwell because he's actually like a propagandist for like the imperialists, basically a traitor. He. But, it's all very Orwellian.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, yeah, it's one, you know, like, nowhere, if you talk about what's going on in Syria, and these, you know, talk about fighting ISIS. And wait a second. In Syria, we're supporting ISIS, and the Russians are fighting ISIS. And there, nowhere, I mean, it's almost as if there's no clarification. Like, you would think, just in the mainstream press, this contradiction would be mentioned or dealt with. And
yeah, if we had an actual press that was like journalists that wanted to like make, like if we live in a like in the movie world where like when you broke a big story it was good for your career, instead it's like these days, you know, if somebody did prove that we were supporting ISIS, they would be like they would end up going Gary Webb. Mm-hmm. And whereas if you like go with the lie, then you'll like keep getting, you know, better and better positions, the better.
Yep.
You cover up stuff and manipulate the American public, the more you'll be rewarded. And the more you tell the truth, the worse it'll be for your career, basically. So that's why there's no investigative journalism anymore.
Yeah, because the difference, even the investigative journalists we were given back in the 70s were fake.
Well, yeah, fake, yeah. Like, yeah. CIA Moore Hirsch, basically just getting leaks from the CIA, and then he's like pretending to be like a big enemy of the CIA when actually he's just telling them what they want us to know.
Or Woodward and Bernstein, right?
Yeah, Woodward was... Yeah,
basically, yeah. Woodward seemed to be like Bernstein's handler in that relationship because, you know, it's one of these, yeah.
Bernstein's not as bad as Woodward, but Woodward is just, like, so terrible. And then, yeah, he made his career writing whitewashed accounts of press of the White House for the next 20 years because it's like, you know, well, I broke Watergate. You trust me, don't you?
Yeah, I broke Watergate.
Ellsberg, another phony. Yeah, all that stuff is just...
Yeah, that, I mean, Ellsberg, he was one that he I guess, worked under Lucien Conan in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And he was, Doug Valentine deconstructs him very well and kind of explains that. Explains like he's sort of a celebrity and he's all the corporate leftists like him because he, you know, he'll talk about Vietnam or nuclear disarmament and these things. And even the Pentagon Papers, but the Pentagon Papers themselves were at least from what I understand it, is the CIA got him to do that to pin all the blame on Vietnam on the Pentagon and take all the blame away from the CIA.
Fletcher Prouty actually pointed that out back in, like, 1975 or something.
Yeah.
Like, when you read the secret TV, he's like, this has all been written to write the CIA out of all these papers.
You know, it's and now he's kind of a celebrity, gets paid, you know, to speak and touring.
Yeah, none of these liberals seem to know that Daniel Ellsberg is not like some wimpy man of conscience. He used to be like a CIA death squad commando, like sneaking around in the jungle at night, stabbing people in the throat and like butchering families and stuff like that. And then when he wasn't doing that, he was hanging out with gangsters and like spying on politicians and stuff. Rand Corporation analyst who's got a conscience at all.
He was screwing gangster girlfriends and things like that in Vietnam. Right?
He knew he got killed because he was screwing this Corsican gangster's girlfriend, and then like Lucien Codine had to go over there and be like, you kill Ellsberg, I want to kill you, and then like, you do not want to get into a gang war with the CIA because our resources are unlimited. Like, your little piddling mafia is nothing compared to us.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Yeah, the big boys. That's what it's like, yeah.
You work for us.
It's like that scene in the Good Shepherd with Matt Damon. Did you see that movie?
Yeah, it's like, we could tell it.
And there's a scene in it where he's meeting, I think it's Joe Pesci's playing the mobster. And it's a typical CIA working with a mob and to unseat Castro. And the guy, the mobster looks at him. He's, you know, Matt Damon is the typical WASP, CIA Yale guy, you know, skull and bones type guy. And he goes, the Catholics, we Italians, we have the church. The Jews, they have their tradition. He says, the coloreds, they have their music. What do you got? He goes, we have the country. He says, you're just visiting. And that's kind of like, I guess you could say, the attitude, I guess. I don't know.
Matt Damon's character is actually is a composite of Shackley and Angleton.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if you look at a photo of Shackley and you look at Matt Damon with those glasses and the blonde hair, that's like how Shackley looked.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And
square jawed.
So, well, anyway, listen, I want to thank you for spending so much time with me this evening. I think we covered, I do recommend, I strongly recommend people read the article, Ted Shackley, Life in the CIA, and also read your ones on Iran-Contra because they're related to what we talked about tonight. Is there anything else? Are you back to writing? I know you're taking sort of a sabbatical from writing. Are you back to writing, or were you expecting anything new?
Yep. The last thing I did was about how the Haitian Revolution helped end slavery around the world. I'm like researching Iran-Contra, but I've read so much about it. I probably will write another Iran-Contra article, though.
Okay.
In like a month or two.
And that'll be on your anti-imperialist U blog?
Yep. And okay. I also cover current wars like Syria and Ukraine.
Because all these wars, I think, what we talked about tonight, the career of Ted Shackley, these dirty wars and involved in this financing, these banks and all that, it's going on today, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's like expanded.
Yeah.
Now there's like twice as many of these covert wars going on as there was like then, like the Reagan era, which was like sort of like the height of all the expansion.
Mm-hmm.
It's like special forces operating in like 100 countries, like.
That's right.
Doing all sorts of stuff.
And it seems to be part of a business model of sort of weakening, destabilizing, then going in and buying up the resources and labor on the cheap.
The privatization has gone like even bigger than since Sackler's time or whatever, where now they have these multi-billion dollar private intelligence firms, although they've always actually been around.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty old. A lot of like the big ones, they have all these new ones and all these mercenary firms and stuff, and so they can just be like, oh, it was Blackwater's fault, but actually it was Doug Valentine says, you know, like the CIA is actually in control of these mercenary firms.
Yeah, that's how the people become successful. They're picked. It seemed like how someone like a certain drug cartel will become successful for a while because they're assets of the intelligence agencies in high finance,
yeah.
Because the drug trade plays as a big part in providing liquidity and funneling, ultimately funding the world's resources into the banking sector, which is, you know, City of London, MI6, CIA, Wall Street.
Well, this is all about looting the planet.
Looting the planet. It's the British East India Company model that's, you know, still in play today, unfortunately. Okay, well, I'm going to let you go. I want to thank you again. Thanks. Perhaps we'll talk.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Oh yeah, you're certainly welcome. It was a great talk. In the near future, have you back on when I we can get in depth into Iran-Contra when I actually get through all those articles.
Sounds cool.
Great. Now, I'll just send you a note on Facebook or something, and you know, so we can maybe set something up for later in the spring.
Sure.
Great. Listen, good luck with your pursuits, your writing, and I'll say good night and take care.
All right.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Well, I found me a little girl and I settled down in a pretty little house in a pretty little town. We got married and promised never to part. And little by little we drifted from each other's hearts. Now I'm driving a stolen car on a pitch black night, and I'm doing my best to make it through. Well, I'm just sitting down here at the Stanton light. I wanna get caught, but I never do. At first I thought it was just restlessness that would fade as time went by and our love grew deep. But in the end it was something more, I guess, that tore us apart and made us weep. And I'm driving a stolen car waiting on that little red light. I keep telling myself everything's gonna be alright. But I ride by night and I travel in fear that in this darkness I might just disappear. She asked if I remember the letters I wrote when our love was young and we were bold. She said last night she read those letters and they made her feel 100 years. There's a river runs by that little town, down into the sea. It was there in the shade I lay my body down as she flowed on so effortlessly. Now there's a party tonight out of County Line. They'll be dancing down at 7. I can see those party lights shine. Maybe she's there, maybe she's looking for me. Last night I dreamed I made the call. I swore to return and stay forevermore. Once again we stood on the wedding steps at Victory Hall and walked arm in arm through the chapel door. I can remember how good I felt inside when the preacher said, son, you may kiss the bride. But as I leaned over to touch her pretty lips,
I felt it all slip away through my fingertips, and I'm driving a stolen car.